Morris, and you are about to embark on the next Pioneer Knowledge Services Because You Need to Know, a digital resource for you to listen to folks share their experience and knowledge around the field of knowledge management and nonprofit work. If your company or organization would like to help us continue this mission and sponsor one of our shows, email BYNTK at pioneer-ks.org.
Hello, everybody. My name is Daniel Ranta. Edwin, thanks for having me on your podcast. It's a real honor for me to be here. I'm actually located in a unique place in the world. It's kind of funny when I tell people when I'm somewhere else, they ask me where you live. I live in Guatemala with my wife. We live just outside of Guatemala City at about 1,000 feet. So we live kind of in the mountains in a beautiful place, a relatively small town where we have the opportunity to help people here in the small town. You know, Guatemala gets sometimes a little bit of a bad rap, but it's actually a beautiful country with really, really nice people, and we really enjoy it. The weather is always really nice. It's kind of fun to do this podcast because I spend about 95% of my time speaking Spanish, so I can speak some English with folks, but I enjoy either language. So the last book I read was The Greatest Beer Run Ever, a memoir of friendship, loyalty, and war, and a really funny piece. I really enjoyed it and could relate to it in a lot of ways of things that happened to me when I was growing up several decades ago. So I highly recommend that book. What I've written recently are about 90 knowledge management related governance articles that I share with in a passionate area where I have a lot of passion. That's teaching at Kent State University, where I've been teaching for about 3 years in their knowledge management program. Writing those articles, governance is shared accountability. So writing those articles that average between 3 and 8 pages is a great way to transfer that know-how, know what, know why to the students. And I'm really excited. I always tell the students that all these articles, you can take them and you can customize them, because the students, I'm talking about 100% work in a knowledge management area. They're graduate students. And so it's a lot of fun to be able to share that kind of tacit knowledge and my experiences over the years with them, so they can take it and customize it for their own organizations. And I'm a big DIY guy. And do it yourself. Whatever project that my wife challenges me on, if I don't know how to do it, I'll watch a YouTube video like a lot of us do to be able to learn. And, you know, it's funny, after you do something that you say, hey, that's relatively simple, and you kind of almost become a pseudo expert at it, and then you can help other people. Somebody told me one time that the reason we're all on earth, and it really clicked for me, this was many, many, many years ago, is to help others. And so we're in a great place to be able to do that here, that type of thing, and help others and help people in my wife's family who live down here in Guatemala also. That's a neat part of it. The best advice that I ever received was my first boss. And I remember I was very nervous when I talked to him the first time. And he was actually more than my boss. He was my boss's boss's boss, his boss's boss. So I got an opportunity to spend 20 or 30 minutes with the head guy in this organization I was working in. He said, Ranta, we love people with can-do attitudes, positive attitudes, you know, to be able to get the work done. To me, that's how I've always been. And I like to carry that forward and share that with others. And there's always a way, there's always a solution, even in times of what some people might perceive as crisis.
So where did that example come in your life? Where did that example of the can-doer come from?
It came from when I just got out of graduate school, my first job. I worked for the investigative arm of the U.S. Congress, and I had an opportunity to meet with this head guy. His name was Walt Herman. You know, you walk in there, and I think when I was that age still, I looked like I was 14 years old. I remember walking into his office, and he told me that, and I was like, hey, this is going to be a good place to work, because I'm all about that.
Well, no, okay, but he recognized that in you, or did he not?
He might have. I mean,
did he just tell
he might have. Yeah. You know, he was a big sports guy and, you know, things like that. And so, and he was also, his son actually played linebacker at Michigan, big time football player and stuff. So there was a nice connection point there.
Where did you get the attributes from to be that? Where did that come from? Genetics, upbringing? What was the,
I think it was probably, that's a good question. You know, it was probably upbringing. Because what are your choices, really? And I always like try to look forward.
You have a mental model already that is kind of the foundation to everything you're talking about, and that it is set to go forward. instead of living in the past or fixating on what's broken right now, you're like, come on, well, let's go over there.
You know, this guy, this is one quick story. It's kind of funny is that this guy I met when I was working for a large oil and gas company in this knowledge management space, he's from Oklahoma. So he had a bit of an Oklahoma accent. He goes, Ranta, when you see a big pile of manure, you start digging in there looking for the pony. I was like, that's a damn good phrase. I like that. I'm digging in there looking.
I'm looking for the pony.
There's got to be a pony in there. God, right?
That's hilarious. There's got to be one in there. Yeah, right? So let's step into this conversation of what our focus is here today, that we want to understand a better, in a clear, concise way, how tacit knowledge is either being ignored or being used in an organization. What do you say?
The classic model always, when I started working in the space, people would use an iceberg where, you know, most of the ice in an iceberg and it's under the water, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It's a frustrating experience when you walk into an organization. I spent about half my career as a consultant and half as a chief knowledge officer in large global organizations. You walk in there and you've got these people working really hard to manage their PDF files and things like that when you know. On top of that, in the global organizations, they were engineering organizations. So they were places where tacit knowledge was 80, 90 or more percent of all the knowledge, and it was about problem solving. So how could you discover from one another and kind of build on each other's thoughts what was really happening to be able to collect that? I call it collective elaboration, to where work is more of an art than a science. Work is mainly an art. You know, it's not a science.
Yeah.
If it were all a science, and that's what people are driving us toward today, that can all be figured out by some AI bot.
Yeah, that and all you need is big data and you'll have all your answers.
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But the human in the loop is definitely your perspective of where organizations have to be now and in the future, regardless of and this is my assumption of what you just said, the ability to have AI or machine run organizations is far into the future. But right now, the human element is the art keeper, is the art implementer of this orchestration called an organization. So how does the art of knowledge sharing develop into a behavior the organization can mimic and reproduce?
Yeah. With my students and wherever I've worked, I always emphasize that this is about leadership, people, and behavior. Mm. And then I love the processes because that's the manifestation of how the knowledge flows within an organization. A couple times I've made a video that featured a famous quote that was attributed to Louis Pasteur around 1854. And what he said was that fortune favors the prepared mind.
Yep.
But you've got to realize that no matter how hard we work as individuals, we can never be prepared for everything. So doesn't it make more sense to be able to connect people and focus on that collaboration? Because for me, intrinsic and built in, integrated into collaboration is always the behavioral aspect in people. So you want to make those kind of connections to be able to build trusted relationships that make a difference, whether people will meet each other or not. In a large global organization, you know, a lot of people will never actually face to face meet each other, especially in the world we live in today.
Yeah. The ability for an organization to be permeable enough to where knowledge is expected to be shared, the culture trusts enough to share, what gives the ability to get into the under-the-hood tacit knowledge? I get what you're saying about the organization builds those behaviors or should be the responsible party for building those behaviors or setting the expectations, but how do you employ going deeper than what's just on the surface?
Well, what I've been doing lately with organizations where I'm consulting, I challenge them in terms of, because a lot of them will come to me and they'll say, I have this maturity model that I developed with a former colleague of mine at GE. The maturity model starts off with, it's kind of Monday through Friday, and starts off with hero organization. Then you get systematic, you get networked, you get fearless, you get to a learning organization. And we built a maturity model to get to those places. And when I show that model, organizations, leaders will tell me, you know, Dan, today I'm going to admit we're a hero organization where thank goodness we have these brokers that are, you know, sharing, and they're energy givers with can-do attitude. Mm. So much of the burden, carrying the burden in terms of being go-to people, and many times overloaded. Information overload is a real thing within organizations.
Yeah.
They'll say, well, we want to get to become a learning organization in the next 6 months. And I'm like, hey, give me a TO, baby. Give me a timeout. because this, what we're talking about here, involves human beings. So you've got to fight like hell to get to Wednesday, which is a networked organization. A centerpiece has always been communities. And then when you want to discover and you want to start to build the tacit knowledge flows, you've got to make sure those communities are sanctioned at the highest levels of the business in terms of what are the real pain points? What are we going after? Where does it hurt the most? Where can we drive more shareholder value? Let's go back and look at that. And that's all possible. I mean, it should be easy for an organization, and it's not possible for an organization, not necessarily easy to discover those pain points. And then when you circle the wagons and get those people in communities and get them going back and forth, you start to tap into the thickest vein in the gold mine of knowledge sharing. It's professional pride, actually. The fact that people care. 99.some percent of people where I've worked or consulted care. And so you tap into that, and then all of a sudden you get this knowledge flowing with nothing. You know, what's the fastest thing that moves in an organization? Rumors or chisme in Spanish, or, you know, gossip. And so you want to kind of put that knowledge sharing on the knowledge train. You want to be able to get the flow of those ideas and get the willingness of people to demonstrate human vulnerability and ask questions of each other.
Let's go back to a definition of tacit. Tacit is not well understood. So the definition I'm pulling up here says, understood or implied without being stated is tacit. Mm-hmm. So now we're kind of compartmentalized the from making things explicit, because in order to make knowledge explicit, that means it's aware in your mind to begin with. Mm-hmm. But in the form of a tacit bit of knowledge, it's almost subliminal in the fact that it may not be top of the mind. And until somebody pokes you with a stick and says, well, what about that over there? Then it's like, oh, well, then you have to explain it. But unless it's apparent to explain it, you're not going to think it. So how do you prime the pump in getting that tacit knowledge out of somebody?
That is the $99,000 question. Yeah. And so it's just put a number. I threw a number out there.
I like that number. That's good. That's a good
and,
number.
And so the thing is, you know, I always tell people it's stuff ping ponging around inside your head. And like you said, that it's second nature. So it's within my DNA because it's the way that I've always worked. But here's the tricky thing. But somebody said famous, you know, the famous politician said, oh, politics is local. Well, I got news for you. Most knowledge is local. So when you're working with global organizations, or really any size organization, it can be something that, like, as you define that, something that somebody doesn't even, I don't even realize that I have this tacit knowledge.
Yeah.
This is how I do it. And this is how I've always done it. And I've kind of figured some other things out along the way. So that's the encouragement and the encouraging in the construct of, say, a global community, and making sure you have the right roles, like core team members, to be able to encourage that behavior. Because from a cultural perspective, when you get people speaking, I've worked with a lot of people that speak English as a second, third, fourth, or fifth language in the world. There's a lot of reluctance to be able to stick your neck out there, even though you may be sitting on that best practice for the entire organization. And as it relates to the tacit knowledge, and if somebody got that knowledge from Indonesia to Norway, that would be fantastic. But how do you make that happen?
Yeah, how do you construct that? Now let's back the train up a little bit, go from this international footprint to maybe just a small organization. What would be your best advice to a small outfit CEO running a place? What would be your advice if they don't have a chief knowledge officer, they don't really have a KM program, but they are listening and they're like, oh yeah, this whole idea of, and it all boils down to continuity and performance. I mean, that's the bonus of putting effort into tacit knowledge harvesting is continuity of the organization, performance of the individual and the job task and all that sort of thing. What's your advice to get somebody moving in that right direction?
I would definitely spend time to share the backgrounds of individuals and complement that with what they're actually working on, who they're working with in terms of customers and clients. There's always stakeholders that you're working with to be able to enlighten others, so that cohesion is degrees of separation. And in a small organization, I'm not going to say it's possible, but it may be a little bit troublesome in terms of too many people connecting with too many people. But that if you could get that cohesion to one degree of separation, famous Kevin Bacon, 6 degrees of separation, so 1 degree is really tight, right? I always know when I face this challenge, okay, I know that Edwin has this and I haven't talked to him for 2 months, but he's got the knowledge. So I'm going to go ahead and ping him, see if he can help me out, get 70% of the way down the pike in a short period of time. That's what I would suggest, that you've got to make sure that people aren't working in a buzzword in this space is a silo. You can bust through that.
All right. So you need to work on the culture is what you're saying. The organization has to reflect that in order to have this cohesion, this ability to have that awareness, then it's more than just hiring right. Mm-hmm. It is actually creating a culture that cares, and go back to your first statement of, you know, people that care seem to do well. And I agree, you know, if there's an element of ownership, and I don't mean ownership like I own the place, but that there's a, as you said, personal pride, professional pride in the work that's being done, then that carries a lot of weight.
No question about it. And people can understand with them that what's in it for me. You know, a lot of times when you motivate and you reward, it's not about remuneration. It's about feeling better about what you're doing to help the organization, to help your constituents, and to solve problems and to get things done, be more productive, getting a shout out from your boss or any other employee. And that's how I like to set things up. When I do a community, I always put a featured member where anybody can nominate anybody else just to thank them publicly. Because what you're trying to do actually is you're not trying to get them to be known in terms of helping somebody else. What you're really trying to do is, in a many-to-many paradigm, you're trying to get other people to say,
That's exactly.
I could do that too.
Yeah, you're trying to switch up and introduce some new behaviors that you would like to see. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. It's an expectation.
So what is the hardest thing about getting tacit knowledge?
The hardest thing is really when I used the phrase earlier in terms of collective elaboration. So since I went to work as the executive director of knowledge management, the first one they had at General Electric in 2015, we built, I think this is an all-time world record, 200 business-focused communities. In 2 years, we rolled them out. We had like a process like you wouldn't believe. I had a great team. 3 taxonomists, great technology support, et cetera. So we had it all. We rolled these out and they were very, very successful. The most challenging thing is when we built them, it was, you know, most companies get stuck with this sea of mediocrity coming out of the box from Redmond, Washington, which is also known as SharePoint. I've always taken and understood how to customize SharePoint to build the right processes for the manifestation of knowledge. Our problem-solving discussion area, what we did was put it into play so that it looked a hell of a lot like Stack Overflow. I love Stack Overflow, kind of like the look and feel of it. So what we did that was way smarter, and we had 330,000 employees across 9 businesses in 187 countries. So the numbers were massive, but we had people nominate expertise, and then we tagged those areas of expertise per the questions and answers that were coming in so that those were immediate alerts. And because when you get tagged, when you tag yourself and you nominate your expertise or you're truly an expert sanctioned, certified in a certain area, Edwin, then you're way more willing. It's not information overflow to help other people. So we tapped into that in that way. But then the most difficult thing to get to your question was, which of those examples of collective elaboration do you want to take a little bit of time out and document as something that becomes explicit and highly then findable and reusable for the organization? That's when we put into play this cool thing. We called it WAS, Wiki as a Service, where you could just hit a button in a closed discussion area, hit the button, and it automatically took the collective elaboration that happened, the original question and all the replies, how people were complimenting each other and working together around the world, and moved it into a wiki article in that community.
That's brilliant.
And so it was there. I love that word brilliant, especially in the context of what we were doing. You know, it was a team effort, I got to tell you. I'm really proud of it. And we made it even better as we went along because there were a lot of, you know, ways you could just smooth it out a little more, as you can imagine. At first, it was a little clunky, but...
What I want to bring up is that you stepped up the process in which it wasn't just left in its original format. You've massaged it. You did some triage. You figured out what's important, what's not. And then you take what's important and you produce something out of it so it can be more consumable, more available, and more useful. So the value can be transferred. But you don't do that for all pieces. You pick out the top, whatever the percentage was out of the volume, to remaster or to add this additional piece to. And I think a lot of organizations don't realize how much work that is to create added value by doing a little extra business intelligence piece or business development of that content.
Totally agree. It was about 5 to 8%, by the way, of the closed discussions. The word we use for discussions actually was not closed, it was resolved. There's a big difference, believe it or not. We did a lot of things. We had an argument for like 2 months to, was the word closed or resolved, but we thought it was resolved in the end. We used the power of the people to help us decide what the right word was going to be. So the questions come in open and then they get transferred over there. When you put something in a wiki, if you don't have an enterprise-wide wiki, you're not doing knowledge management right, because it's a fluid, dynamic environment. It's a series of interlocking web pages. It's like the mortar between the bricks, but you can keep adding to it. So it's not like a PDF file stuck at the bottom of somebody's swimming pool that no one's ever going to go to.
Right.
But you got to think in that way so that you can keep adding to it as the knowledge, as it merits. When it's meritorious, make it better.
If you're going to walk into an organization and just check out how they're doing knowledge management, you're telling me your top five things you got to have is inclusive of a wiki. That's still a viable product now?
No question about it.
Yeah? Okay.
You want to complement your community with a wiki portal space, and that's where you're going to put that. See, these are seminal articles, Edwin. Think of a bullpen of, man, if we only knew about these 30, 40, 50, 80 things, then all of a sudden, and we used the power of the people to develop those, and then we made sure that it was a best bet when we did a search to find that knowledge, things start to come into, wow, that's already been... And, or when you're typing in your question, that's popping up in a little box next to it. Hey, that's already been written about. Here it is. You want to check that out? Maybe that diffuses even the need to be able to ask a question.
Even ask to begin with, yeah. So you bring up a good point that is usually a stick in the eye for an organization, is because they do not have a formal method or actually a practice of researching what they already have, researching what they already know, or researching what they already have done as a first formal step to doing anything. But you're saying the wiki gives you that opportunity to have express documentation available and searchable and findable to at least be that first review of what else has the organization done, at least give a shortcut answer to somebody that's looking for an answer. Not just the length, but just the amplitude of how much content or value, how much value is being reserved in the organization towards that future use or intended use of this content.
Exactly. And then what happens is that your constituents, those members of that business-focused community, can create, in wiki parlance, it comes from MediaWiki. I call it a red link. A red link is, you know, if you open up a red link, it's a polar bear in a snowstorm. There's nothing in there, but it's where you determine, you know what, in terms of that bullpen where we're putting our arms around the seminal knowledge, if we had an article, we should have an article about this, because the doggone thing keeps coming up time and time again. And so you start to get people thinking about what they do want to document, what they do want to take from stuff that's tacit and make it explicit. Will it ever be perfect? Will it ever be enough? No, but that's, you know, that's the fact that work is more of an art than a science.
Well, what is your definition of knowledge management?
Well, it starts with being able to define from a business perspective what's most important, and then circle the wagons in terms of the leadership, the behavior, the people, being able to get the right flows of knowledge, those processes to be put in place. So many organizations have good intentions, but they haven't developed a strategy. And a strategy in knowledge management is more like an ecosystem. This class that I teach at Kent State is called Designing and Implementing KM in the Workplace. And I set the whole thing up in terms of these swim lanes or strategic focus areas. There's 9 of them that cover what you want to include. And these are the governance articles. It covers all of those areas that you want to think about, from how you create business value right on through to how you create a learning organization, the technology, the processes, the content, the taxonomy, how you define expertise and experts. All that is all integrated in. You know, I've had great feedback from my students, and so I think it's pretty complete and it's pretty understandable.
What's apparent to me is that most organizations, in my experience, don't have a lot of governance when it comes to knowledge handling, knowledge development, and long-term use of knowledge as an asset. And I know the term asset is an issue to some people, but knowledge asset works for me. But the idea that organizations either buy a technology solution without the proper governance, then it's always a matter of catch up and hope to the technology.
No question about it. you know, you're playing the hope game and you're out there messing around with a bunch of files that aren't, you know, and the search engine doesn't work. It's just like one thing after another. And
yeah.
There's good intention. Sometimes it's a bunch of IT people thinking that they have the, nothing against IT people. I don't want to.
What? No. What? What are you talking about?
All right, I'm gonna
I don't know what
statement.
You're talking about whatsoever.
I'm going to semi-retract that statement.
Your chief technology officer should not be driving your knowledge management behaviors.
Yeah.
So if you had to pick out of, and I'm going to guess here, which of the three main elements of knowledge management are the weakest link for you? Technology, people, or process?
Well, the weakest link is always technology because there's all these... These all these companies that will take you to the promised land. I mean, I remember the first time I went to KM World, I was like, holy smokes. I mean, it was just like,
yep.
I felt like a fish out of water because it was all about technology. Now I'm throwing some more people under a bus here, but whatever. It was all about technology, you know, build it and they will come. That's where there's a great scene, you know, follow the shoe, follow the gourd. You remember who that's from, right?
No, tell
Monty
me.
Python.
Ah!
There were these two guys trying to get this crowd of people to follow them. And then they just came up with these animate objects. And they were like, one guy said, follow the shoe, follow the cord. You know, it's like, what are you really talking about there?
Yeah.
What does it mean? And where does it take us?
Talking about where does it take us, where should we go as a field? The world of knowledge management, where should it go?
I think that what I've been talking about, an umbrella for me is respecting people and being as inclusive as possible for organizations, whether it's small, medium, or large. And when you kind of have that overall approach to be able to include everybody, collaboration is a game of connectivity where you want to get the diversity of thought in a real sense out there. And so much of it then happens. I mean, just think about the percentage, you know, this organization said, you know, 70% of all learning happens on the job. Well, it's probably more than that, right? You know, so it is important. I mean, it's how we work, regardless of what you're doing, how the knowledge flows. And I agree with you that knowledge are their assets, their knowledge objects. They're out there, whether it's tacit or explicit. And you've got to be able to respect the inclusivity and diversity of thought in your organization to be able to push this thing forward. And to create a really good, sustainable, long-term strategy to be able to put this in place.
How does an organization best put into practice the behaviors they seek out that they want to have in a learning, diversified organization? Is that in everybody's job description that they're all responsible for the knowledge flow? Or how do you do that? How do you make it happen?
I think it should be in everybody's. But however, to make this happen in an accelerated fashion, when you think back at Malcolm Gladwell is a brilliant author, and he's written three books, a triad of books that are fantastic. His first one was The Tipping Point. You know, he talked about salespeople, mavens, you know, these connectors out there. And I just had an experience working with a large company, a Fortune 150 company, and transforming their communities. And the work that I did, the blessing was that they'd been relatively primitive, but they had these communities and it all really only featured an out-of-the-box SharePoint discussion area. But based on that data for 15 years, we were able to go back and find who those brokers, those people, again, with the positive attitudes, the can-do attitudes.
Yep. The can-doers.
Yep. Yeah. And we leveraged those people around the world to be able to, in a network sense, make this as contagious as possible. So you want to give yourself the greatest opportunity by identifying those people to the extent possible. I was fortunate. I had the opportunity early on when I was working at IBM to be part of a team with Rob Cross and Andrew Parker, a couple of real leaders at the time, well over 20 years ago, in terms of organizational network analysis or social network analysis, SNA, work to be able to find those people and techniques you can use. So it's something that is real and it's human engineering in a sense, and that you're trying to find those people to give you the greatest chance to be successful in the least period of time.
And what you're saying, you know, I keep going back to 20 years ago when I can't remember who coined the term, but it overused KM evangelist, you know, the one that gets it and promotes it and makes it more interesting for those on the sidelines to show value. But how do you get those folks to, one, be the ambassador and to have authority to be the ambassador. Here again, we go back to job descriptions. In some organizations, in my experience, has been, oh, if it's not in your job, you sure as hell aren't going to do that. No, it's got to be within the constraints of what we're paying you for, kind of thing. Versus, we need to have these folks be a part of this mission. I'll call it a mission, this overture of what we want out of the organization. How do you make the slow conversion? How do you make the conversion from what I would call a static organization to a dynamic?
That's where you want to be able to focus most of your attention, because in my case, I've worked for large global engineering-oriented organizations. Command and control culture, what your boss finds interesting, you need to find fascinating, was a famous quote that somebody told me. And that's definitely the case.
Yeah.
Well, that's why it's so important to not ask somebody to do something completely different. And you want to be able to tap into the people who are already naturally doing that. It gives you a way greater opportunity to be successful. And then when you share with them what you want them to do, you got to keep it light. You're already doing these eight things. There's two other things that are real easy. They're like a layup in basketball. Mm-hmm. Everybody can make a layup, right? And that's how I try to communicate to people how we're trying to get a leg up on changing the culture. Yeah. And then do all the things that, like I mentioned earlier, when it comes to, you know, rewarding, recognizing featured members, things like that. Yeah. Oh, I can do that too. Yeah. And that kind of thing. And it fills in the gaps.
In the corporate world of the chief finance officer, how do you translate everything you've said, these actions in your past business lives? Just flip that to say, what's your ROI on all this?
Well,
what do you give the number crunchers as a bottom line? This is how much we've
I've been fortunate that I've been able to partner and learn from. First, that the term was functional excellence with a large global oil company. They taught me so much, and they were senior people that in the functional excellence context were really getting a good understanding of where they needed to focus their attention, where it hurt the most, where we ultimately set up communities. We call them networks. And it gave us the ability to be able to focus on hardcore numbers, the barrels of oil equivalent difference that in terms of enhancing production around the world, mm-hmm. things like that, mm-hmm. that was huge. And we had huge savings that we were able mm-hmm. to demonstrate based on sharing best practices around the world and things like that. And you got to get to a certain point, and you got to work really hard in serious organizations like that to be able to demonstrate the value that's being added. You get to a point, and we got there in about 5 years in this case, where we could kind of tap the brakes a little bit on, you know, it's kind of like the thing, you know, actually I've Googled this. If you haven't, you should Google it. When a tree falls in the forest, does it make a noise? There's a bunch of research out there on that topic. After a while, when you've got a really serious problem solving happening, people turning tacit into explicit, documenting things, solving things, making improvements, do you really need to spend mm-hmm. so much time documenting all the knowledge?
As you're saying that, I'm like, what's the comparable in human life? And that'd be like, oh, you don't know the benefits of drinking water? Well, here, let me show you. You know, we've done all these studies. Yeah, I get it. Drinking water, I need it. Yeah, I got it. Yeah, it's biology. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I get your point, because you're continually trying to prove something that's already been proven. Like it's going to go away. It'll be unproven next week. You know,
exactly.
When you were talking about the pain points of your organization, all I could think about was rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. And the physical framework was arthritis. Organizations can become arthritic to the point where they're contracted and they're tight and they're not flexible mm-hmm. and all those sorts of things. But I like that idea when you're identifying pain points of an organization, because if you can increase flexibility, if you can increase flexibility by 20%, then that's a win. You know, does mm-hmm. it equal dollars and cents? Maybe. If the metric is flexibility or retention mm-hmm. or conversations or on and on.
The extension of that, actually, I'm glad you like that point about the pain points, because the extension is building the right knowledge architecture so that you can show how, for example, communities should be expected to be able to interact with others. Because sometimes you'll have a community with a slight overlap, like we're doing this, we're doing that. You know, the last thing you want is, you know, people like fighting over what, you know, the scope is
and what you're doing.
So what we developed, and this is super cool, what I'm about to tell you. I love this. I'm really proud of the teams that I led that were able to create this at first at the large oil company. And the way we did it at GE was super cool. It's called sister community sharing. So it seems relatively easy, but it became so powerful that posting a question out there, you identify which communities in your sister communities. You know, we had hundreds of communities at GE, like I mentioned, but you might only have 10 or 15 sister communities. And this involves welding. Then you don't want to just satisfy and accept what's just good enough in your own scope of your own community. You want to make sure you get those people that are closer, that degrees of separation, cohesion, drive that down, get the people that are welding all the time. And welding was something that was done across all 9 businesses at GE. So exactly, that was a sister community that was really important. So get them involved in the game. And with professional pride, they'd be like, oh yeah, you know, we do that all the time. This is how you got to do it. You got to be careful with this and, you know, that kind of thing. The sister community sharing, it's a unique thing to me. It's so commonsensical. I've never heard of any organization that does it. Maybe they do it in some way, but it's essential.
I'm trying to think of how you could translate that to a social media prospect now. That basically would be cross-posting, mm-hmm. yeah. right? Where you've got a main group that is X, but, you know, it could be an interest over here in a matrix kind of thing. What'd you have? Eight swim lanes, nine lines of business, whatever the primaries were.
Yeah.
Those are the main communities. And across from that, you know, you've got specialties or skill sets that cross all or some or most of the swim lanes, right? Like in your saying welding, because it's its own community in respect to just that function, welding.
Exactly. Exactly. So they solve some things within, but then they're go-to. The best communities are the go-to communities because they're the ones that everybody recognizes they go to. Other communities are good when they push things out to others, the ones that move in that direction, but it needs to flow in both directions. It needs to be accommodated. And the message fidelity has to be. So wherever I post, you don't want people posting all over and then trying to catch up, cut and paste. It's ridiculous, you know? So the message fidelity has got to be really good. It shows up and it always has an indigenous location where the question was posted, but everything else, it just looks so smooth.
What's your top 3 bits of advice for a small organization that's trying to get going in this day and age where tools are not lacking?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would start with, I would go right back to the overall mission is why a company exists. And I would go back to their vision, their destiny. I would want to understand, I would do a gap analysis by talking to people or getting people together to be able to understand what is it that we've got, how do we fill in that gap as we do our gap analysis. And then that's where you're really identifying your key knowledge needs at that point. What do we need to know in order to be able to get there, both internally and externally? Externally as well, external knowledge. Organizations need to be porous in terms of being able to bust through their own borders to be able to grab knowledge from other locations.
Yes.
It goes back to Louis Pasteur. He said, you know, fortune favors a prepared mind, but as an individual, we can't know everything internally or externally, even if it's a small organization. Understanding those in the context of what the organization is trying to achieve and where your gaps are. And at that point, then you can start to understand how can we build the most commonsensical flows of knowledge to be able to help each other out as we go along the way, and then make decisions on the fly in terms of what it is, what governance materials. Governance is really a reflection of tacit knowledge that's become explicit. Every community, every area should have a bullpen of seminal articles. And because you want to be able to, a lot of times small organizations have a lot of turnover. So you don't want people coming in and they start on day one with no clue. You want to jumpstart them with existing knowledge, be able to give them the greatest chance to get up to speed. So many times, how can you compress the time to competency for those new hires? I always like to go back to that Monday through Friday that I worked out, worked together with Dr. Najjar from GE. He and I put together that maturity model from hero to systematic to network to fearless to learning organization. And how do you get there? What are the steps, concrete, tangible, non-ambiguous steps that we need to take to give us the greatest chance to become a learning organization?
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, and I think organizations will appreciate your overview of where you've been and what you've tried and what you've succeeded in doing. So thank you for being here, Daniel.
Well, it's been my pleasure. You know, I enjoyed talking to you. The time just went boom, like that. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Because You Need to Know, the reference podcast in knowledge management. My name is Sonny Toneme. As an art administrator, Because You Need to Know has been my go-to podcast and has helped me hone my management skills. Please consider sponsoring the podcast with your business.
just finished our latest Because You Need to Know, a public service of Pioneer Knowledge Services. Please join us on LinkedIn and find us at pioneer-ks.org.